This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذي صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. The Taliban say the group welcomes good diplomatic relations with the world following the complete withdrawal of Western forces from Afghanistan after 20 years of military intervention. More than 1 million houses and businesses in Louisiana remain without power a day after Hurricane Ida slammed into the U.S. state. Also, Australia's Canberra extends its hard lockdown by a further 2 weeks as the capital city struggles to contain a surge in the highly infectious Delta variant. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the top spokesman for the Taliban has called the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces from Afghanistan a good lesson for invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
Zabihullah Mujahid made the comments hours after the last U.S. troops left Afghanistan following 20 years of military presence. He called the departure a victory for the whole nation. He said the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has come to ensure security and protect the dignity of the people. Mujahid noted that the Taliban want to have good diplomatic relations with the world and the U.S. The group seized the Afghan capital in mid-August following a lightning advance against the government. Following that, tens of thousands of Afghans and foreigners flew out of the country through Kabul Airport to meet an August 31st departure deadline. In order to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Tim Anderson. He is a director for Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. So after 20 years of military presence, the U.S. finally withdrew its forces from Afghanistan and the Taliban took control of the country. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think the statement from the Taliban is correct. Whatever you think of the Taliban, in substance, it is certainly a victory for the Afghan people that they can go back to square one and start to rebuild their own social structures. It's never possible to build accountable social structures based on an occupation force or colonization. Western states should have learned that lesson. Clearly, they don't recognize that lesson. They still believe in some form of colonization is somehow going to be helpful in some sorts of way. So I think it is the assertion of independence by the Afghan people is an important thing. The next step is to see what's going to happen in terms of the new regime there.
And how do you assess the future of Afghanistan, about the future government that is going to be formed in the country, and also its ties with the U.S., with the regional countries, and other probably European countries?
Well, I think there's been great damage done to Afghan social structures over decades now, and the last 20 years has aggravated that. In a sense, Afghanistan has a lot of deficit to catch up with, and there's going to be a difficult adjustment time there. One sign of hope, though, is that the Taliban Mark II has made some quite clear statements about things which I think are at least a recognition of the reality. One is that they have tried to play down their sectarian past by having members from other ethnic groups as part of their structure. Second, they've made some statements about the education and participation of women in professions and so on, in particular, which remains to be seen, but nevertheless is an important recognition. And thirdly, they've engaged in a series of talks with some important neighbours, in particular China and Iran, that show that they have put a lot more thought into their future relationships and their economic strategic relationships with their neighbours, with whom they have had differences in the past. And I think that's very important. I think it also underlines the fact that there will be a break with the U.S. occupation, in the sense that the U.S. has been playing with trying to weaken the influence of China in the region, trying to undermine Iran in the region, and the Taliban have said we're not going to have any part of that. I think that's a positive sign.
Do you think that Afghanistan can recover and thrive under the Taliban rule?
That's another question, and I think it remains to be seen. We shouldn't be falsely optimistic about that. There is a extreme sectarian roots in their ideology, and to what extent they're able to be practically flexible remains to be seen. But because they have made this effort over a number of years to develop better relationships with the neighbours, those all around them, I think there's reason to be modestly hopeful about the future. I think that Afghanistan will have to go through a lot of changes over the years, but at least it will be something based on the will and the pressures from Afghan people.
And one last question for you. Do you think that the U.S. will stop its intervention in Afghanistan?
I think it has decided to stop its direct occupation of Afghanistan, and it may well try and maintain its so-called prerogatives to send missile attacks, and I think it's very likely to maintain an economic blockade, or let's say extend the economic warfare, the economic siege measures that the U.S. has against virtually all the independent countries in West Asia at the moment. I think it will do that as some sort of sour grapes. I remember when they withdrew from Vietnam, they had these economic siege measures on Vietnam for very many years. They're very bad losers, so I don't think they'll give up all their options or admit defeat, but I think that the direct occupation and all of the terrible outcomes of that, and the regular bombing of civilians in Afghanistan, that I think has come to an end. There's been a great defeat for the U.S. occupation there, and I believe it's going to flow on to other countries in the region too. I think that we'll pretty soon see U.S. withdrawals from Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, and that's certainly to be welcomed.
Thank you so much for your contribution to the program. I've been talking to Tim Anderson. He is a director for the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us out of Sydney. The UN Security Council has adopted a resolution calling on the Taliban to provide a safe passage for Afghans and foreign nationals who want to leave the country. The resolution, drafted by the United States, Britain, and France, was passed with 13 votes in favor. China and Russia abstained. The measure, however, does not mention the creation of a safe zone, which had been requested by French President Emmanuel Macron. The resolution also calls on the Taliban to allow for safe and unhindered access for the United Nations and other agencies to provide humanitarian assistance. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says his country has suspended its diplomatic presence in the Afghan capital.
As of today, we've suspended our diplomatic presence in Kabul and transferred our operations to Doha, Qatar, which will soon be formally notified to Congress. Given the uncertain security environment and political situation in Afghanistan, it was the prudent step to take. 18 days ago, the United States and our allies began...
Blinken was speaking after the U.S. military said it had completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan. It said fewer than 200 Americans remain in Afghanistan who want to leave, and the U.S. will continue to try to get them out. The top American diplomat said the Taliban would need to live up to their commitments to provide freedom of travel, respect of the rights of women and minorities. He urged the Taliban to not allow Afghanistan to become a base for terrorism. A U.S. drone strike has killed at least 10 civilians in Afghanistan. The U.S. claims a drone targeted a suspected suicide bomber in Kabul amid recent deadly attacks in the capital claimed by Daesh. Some Afghans describe such a U.S. raid as arbitrary. Others have urged the Taliban to form a government sooner to prevent chaos in the country.
Americans launched an airstrike in Jalalabad, and yesterday they did the same in Kabul and even confirmed that they had attacked ISIS. They do not have a legal license to carry out attacks in Afghanistan arbitrarily.
The United States was here for 20 years to serve Afghanistan, but all the infrastructure it built was temporary, not permanent. When Russia came here, it built buildings for the people and the government that still stands. But the Americans destroyed everything they built before leaving the country, just like the government they built here. A president fled before the United States left.
Our only demand from the Taliban forces is that they take control of the security of the city of Kabul so that such rocket incidents can be prevented. And they should form a government quickly so that the people of Afghanistan can leave easily.
We want the Islamic government to form their cabinet as soon as possible and for the Islamic government to start working in Afghanistan so that it can prevent this insecurity.
More than a million homes and businesses remain without power in the U.S. state of Louisiana after Monster Hurricane Ida struck. The hurricane tore roofs from buildings and caused massive flooding. It downed trees and power lines, many of them still live in floodwaters. That caused a total power outage in the worst-hit city of New Orleans. The Category 4 storm killed two people and trapped scores of coastal residents under floodwaters. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has called the damage caused by Ida catastrophic. It's the strongest hurricane ever to hit Louisiana. Ida made landfall there on Sunday, bringing winds of 240 kilometers per hour. It weakened to a tropical depression Monday night. Australia has extended by 2 weeks a COVID lockdown in the capital Canberra to contain a surge in Delta variant cases. The lockdown began 3 weeks ago. However, daily COVID cases continued to rise in Canberra. On Tuesday, the city registered 13 new infections. The outbreak there is believed to have spread from New South Wales. That's the epicenter of the current Delta outbreak in Australia. On Tuesday, the southeastern state registered more than 1,100 new cases. Daily infections there have been steadily rising despite lockdowns in the past several weeks. The authorities have kept restrictions in place as a vaccination rollout goes on slowly across the country. A group of climate activists have staged a sit-in protest in the British capital, London, bringing the traffic to a halt.
The streets are free!
Around 200 members of the Extinction Rebellion group blocked the Tower Bridge to protest against the government's investment in fossil fuels. They chose the location as it's in the vicinity of London's financial district. The group accuses the finance industry of funding climate change. Police made about a dozen arrests. The sit-in was part of the group's fifth wave of mass protests on the environmental issues. Four Syrian soldiers have been killed and 15 others wounded after terrorists targeted security checkpoints in the southern city of Daraa. Syrian media reported that the terrorists also targeted some residential neighborhoods in the city, injuring civilians, including a child and her mother. The attacks undermined a Russian-brokered truce agreement that allowed some militants to leave the city for northern Syria. The Syrian army later responded by targeting terrorist hideouts in several areas with missile launchers. Muhammad Ali earlier joined us from Damascus and gave more details about a situation in the southern Syrian city of Daraa.
The terrorist groups inside Daraa al-Balad and in other parts of Daraa countryside never stopped attacking the Syrian army positions and checkpoints since 2018. But let's speak about this period of time. In the past 2 months, there have been negotiations between the Syrian army and the terrorist groups over here. What happened was that 2 days ago, the so-called Central Negotiations Committee, which represents the various terrorist groups in Daraa al-Balad, announced the collapse of negotiations and started attacking both civilian areas in government-held parts of Daraa, also Syrian army checkpoints. Today, those terrorists attacked Syrian army checkpoints, killing four Syrian army soldiers and injuring 15 others, and they also attacked with mortar shells various parts of Daraa, also injuring and killing civilians. Now, for 2 days, in the past 2 days, they have been attacking those areas, and what the Syrian army is doing, despite the fact that the army can launch a wide military offensive and eliminate the presence of those terrorists, but because there are civilians, what the Syrian army is trying to do is to reach a deal without a military solution, peacefully end the presence of terrorists.
In Pakistan, dozens of people have come together to mark the International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearances. According to figures released by human rights groups, over 8,000 people have been abducted by intelligence agencies under the pretext of war on terror. Muhammad Touri reports from Karachi.
Fury raging in the streets of Pakistan on the International Day of Enforced Disappearances that originated in military dictatorship, but the practice continued in subsequent civilian governments.
Victims' families are outraged at Khan administration's inaction over what they call the state kidnapping. Their only request from the government is to prosecute their loved ones in the court of law and follow the due process if they have breached any law.
The protest was organized by Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
Today we are here in front of Karachi Press Club. As you know, all from all nations, people are here in different regions of Pakistan. They are demanding for the safe release of their loved ones. I am also a victim of enforced disappearance. My father has been kidnapped by the secret state, secret forces when he was on his duty.
First post 9/11 reported cases of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children in 2003 from the streets of Karachi by CIA with the help of local secret services.
We arranged combined march, united march, along with Shia missing persons, Hindi missing persons, Baloch missing persons, Pakhtun missing persons. Victim families are sitting here outside the governor house, and they are demanding that if someone is guilty, then give him a trial, fair and free trial in the courts of Pakistan.
We recently, and the Baloch and the Shia missing persons, Pashtun missing persons are protesting here. We held a march from Gora Kabristan to here, our governor house. We are demanding here from the Riyasat that where are our people, where are our workers, where are our nationalists, who are belong with some kind of parties.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Muhammad Touri, Karachi.
Well, that's a wrap for this edition of World News.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other world leaders have received assurances from the Taliban that foreign nationals and those with authorization to exit Afghanistan will be free to leave, as tensions and bloodshed escalate on the streets of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Rajiv Sial, Jason Burke, and Patrick Winter. The piece is titled Taliban Assure World Leaders They Will Let Eligible People Leave Afghanistan. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other world leaders have received assurances from the Taliban that foreign nationals and those with authorization to exit Afghanistan will be free to leave, as tensions and bloodshed escalate on the streets of Kabul. On Sunday, 29th of August, U.S. military forces launched a strike against a vehicle which the Americans claimed was full of ISIS terrorists who were allegedly planning to attack Kabul airport. According to reports, there were multiple fatalities, including a number of Afghan children. The U.S. military has confirmed it is assessing the possibility of having killed or injured civilians in the airstrike. A significant number of British citizens told The Guardian they continue to wait at Kabul airport in the hope of being rescued despite the terror threats and the departure of all UK troops at the weekend. They sent video footage of several people clasping UK passports and pleading for help. Desperate Afghans have been told to cross the border into neighboring countries to escape the Taliban takeover. On Monday, 30th of August, the United Nations Security Council is expected to discuss the Taliban's reassurances, revealed in a statement on Sunday evening after deepening concerns over the plight of thousands of Afghans with Western links who are at their mercy. France and Britain were expected to table an emergency United Nations Security Council resolution calling for any new Afghan government to back a safe zone at Kabul airport to allow evacuation efforts to continue, French President Emmanuel Macron said, though a Whitehall source claimed Emmanuel Macron's comments were premature. In a joint statement released on Sunday by the British government along with the United States and more than 90 other countries, it was confirmed that the Taliban had said anyone who wished to leave the country could do so, though the Taliban's pledges will be greeted with skepticism. The joint statement said, "We have received assurances from the Taliban that all foreign nationals and any Afghan citizen with travel authorization from our countries will be allowed to proceed in a safe and orderly manner to points of departure and travel outside the country." Last week, the Taliban caused shockwaves by moving to prevent Afghan citizens from leaving the country, declaring the route to Kabul airport open only to foreign nationals. Western military forces have been trying to evacuate Afghans who have supported foreign operations as they fear they and their families could be in harm's way for working with Western powers during the 20-year war. The Taliban's latest assurances are part of delicate negotiations as the new government seeks to work with foreign governments. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Sunday that if the Taliban want diplomatic recognition and aid funding, they would have to ensure safe passage for those who want to leave the country. Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, is expected to use a US-chaired meeting with ministers from Qatar, Turkey, fellow G7 partners and NATO on Monday to stress the importance of ensuring the Taliban stand by the commitment to allow safe passage for foreign nationals and Afghan citizens authorized to enter third countries. In a further development, Britain is being urged to spearhead an international plea to fund refugee camps in countries bordering Afghanistan. John Healey, the Shadow Defence Secretary, said ministers had failed to involve critical partners in the region to avoid the current crisis, despite knowing for months that the withdrawal of US forces would happen this year. Britain must lead international efforts to get neighbouring countries to set up safe haven camps, he said. There has to be hard cash on the table to fund safe haven camps and the countries willing to take them. It comes after 15,000 people were evacuated from Afghanistan by British troops over the course of nearly 2 weeks under Operation Pitting, believed to be the largest evacuation mission since the Second World War. Whitehall sources believe that up to 9,000 other people with links to the British government could be left behind, however. Those remaining will be expected to reach a third country, such as Pakistan, Tajikistan, or Uzbekistan, in order to be resettled in Britain. British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sir Laurie Bristow, who had remained in the country and relocated the embassy to Kabul Airport to process as many evacuees as possible, has now arrived back in the United Kingdom on Sunday, 29th of August, landing at RAF Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire. The final flight prompted criticism from senior military figures over the role of the British government, which was accused of failing to act on pleas to ensure the safety of Afghans who had helped soldiers. General Lord Dannatt, the former head of the British Army, told Times Radio, back in July, 45 senior officers wrote to the government saying they are people we are concerned about, and if we don't do the right thing, their blood will be on our hands. It is unfathomable why it would appear that the government was asleep on watch. Vice Admiral Ben Key, the Chief of Joint Operations who commanded Operation Pitting, admitted there was a sense of sadness that not all could be saved. Speaking at RAF Bryce Norton on Sunday morning, 29th of August, he said, "I pay testament to everything that has been achieved by coalition forces. In the end, we know there are some really sad stories of people who have desperately tried to leave, that no matter how hard our efforts, we have been unsuccessful in evacuating." Meanwhile, Colonel Richard Kemp, the former commander of British soldiers in Afghanistan, told Times Radio that Britain now faced a great danger from terrorism. Witnesses on Sunday reported an explosion near Kabul Airport, and television footage showed black smoke rising into the sky. Taliban officials confirmed the US account. The strike came 3 days after a suicide attack at Kabul Airport that killed more than 180 people, including at least 3 British nationals and 13 US service members. The Taliban condemned the strike, saying it had violated Afghanistan's sovereignty. Zabihullah Mujahid, a spokesman for the Taliban, said civilians had suffered casualties in the US strike on Sunday and a house had been hit. The Taliban and the US military have increased security around Kabul Airport since last Thursday's attack. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said on Saturday, 28th of August, that Washington believed there were still specific and credible threats against Kabul Airport. "We would expect future attempts," he said. "We are monitoring these threats very, very specifically, virtually in real time."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sky may be the only place you can find peace in Afghanistan, because from up here, bad incidents become so small that they're not visible anymore. If the only criterion is people, life in Afghanistan goes on, like anywhere else in the world. In here, people live together despite their differences. In today's Afghanistan, it doesn't matter if life goes on fast or slowly. In here, incidents set the cycle of life in motion, or even stop it. People have no role in these incidents. Incidents come to the country from outside. The problem in Afghanistan today is these incidents. from New York to Kabul.
Part 1.
If you type Afghanistan in Google, you'll come across many military and horrible incidents. In 2020, Afghanistan ranked last on the list of all the countries in the world. This report reveals a bitter reality. The question is, what put Afghanistan in this situation in recent years? Maybe if we go back two decades in time, we can find an answer to our question. Two decades before 2021 was 2001. Afghanistan's destiny changed that year.
Moments later, the president walked in.
On September 11th, 2001, then U.S. President George Bush was visiting a school. His worried face revealed that something concerning had happened. At 8:46 a.m., the first tower was targeted. At 9:03 a.m., the second tower was hit. A major event was unraveling. Four suicide missions with passenger planes in a single day. 9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 fact-finding commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated, did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan. He was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005. He was the head of the National Security Council for some time. He was also the head of the Saudi spy agency from 2012 to 2014. His influence in the Bush administration paved the way for the tragic event. September 13, 2001, 2 days after the September 11th attacks. Bandar bin Sultan, along with Bush and his team, are on the Truman balcony of the White House.
Almost 3,000 American victims and their families deserve justice. They deserve the right in a court of law to be able to present the evidence that they have gathered, which is voluminous, that will link the kingdom and other entities of Saudi Arabia to the 19 hijackers.
all the fact-finding commission was saying was Saudi Arabia was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the most obvious question is, then why did the U.S. attack Afghanistan immediately after the 2001 attacks? If the U.S. was supposed to attack somewhere, it should have been Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On October 7, 2001, the CIA Special Forces were the first Americans who entered Afghanistan via Pakistan, and the large-scale aerial attacks followed afterwards. From New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania to Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar. The false flag 9/11 attacks were the excuse to rein in the impoverished country. Afghanistan had no role in what had happened. It's really interesting that Fox News saying, according to a survey, 92% of the youth in Afghanistan have not even heard anything about the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. did not set foot in Afghanistan for the first time in 2001, but it was the early 1980s. The importance of Afghanistan's oil and gas reserves in Central Asia started a new rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies.
In 1979, the Soviet forces occupied Afghanistan. Carter immediately tasked the CIA with taking countermeasures. Zbigniew Przesensky, Carter's national security advisor, came up with a scheme. He decided to deploy some radical and Arab militia forces in Afghanistan.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed. That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail, and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
On the other hand, he decided to organize the domestic militia forces. Money, weapons, and extremism. It was a dangerous combination.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, we had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan, and then we said, great, goodbye. Leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well armed.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., sought to export the Wahhabi ideology to Afghanistan through Arab militants. One of its clear examples was bin Laden. As a Saudi national, he was linked to the powerful Saudi network.
Let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's great, let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam.
In the end, it was the Afghan people who fell victim to the war between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The tragic thing was extremist Wahhabism crept into Afghanistan.
Their support for the 9/11 hijackers has been to encourage Saudi Arabia to be involved in more of the same. They've continued to fund Al-Qaeda. They were a significant part of the establishment of ISIS. They have supported madrasas, which teach young people hatred and intolerance, of mosques, which preach jihad to adults. All those things have happened after 9/11.
The U.S. and Saudi support for radicalism in Afghanistan did not end with extremist militias or Al-Qaeda. Daesh was a new disaster that came to Afghanistan. hundreds of dead and wounded, was the result of Daesh presence in Afghanistan.
Why was it that this extremism came from your schools and from your mosques?
And in part, I blame ourselves also in hindsight. Because are there things that we could have done? Probably. But at the time that this was all, that all these forces were being unleashed, you deal with them at the time.
Under such circumstances, and due to the insecurity in Afghanistan, although the U.S. had spent over $2 trillion in the country from 2001 to 2021, it failed to restore minimum peace to the country. To get a clear picture of how big the number is, think of, for example, $62 billion. It is almost equal to the U.S.'s annual budget needed to stay in Afghanistan. It is more than the entire U.K. military budget and more than the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's budget. After the massive failure in Afghanistan, Trump decided to put an end to U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Why are we there? We're 6,000 miles away. Where Taliban is here, ISIS is here, and they're fighting each other. I said, why don't you let them fight? Why are we getting in the middle of it? I said, let them fight. They're both our enemies. Let them fight. They go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
With Trump's strategy, it was predictable that he would face major differences with the U.S. military commanders. The top military official regarding Afghanistan was General James Mattis.
Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
He confessed to the failure in Afghanistan and believed that the process of failure had been expedited because of Trump's measures. That's why Trump was dissatisfied with General Mattis more than anyone else. As he was a businessman, Trump's economic approach was meant to make profits in Afghanistan, or at least make up for the money spent in the country. Blackwater is a notorious name among private security contractors. Eric Prince was the director of the firm and Trump's unofficial military advisor. Prince tried to provide an answer for Trump in Afghanistan. He presented Trump with a plan to tackle the financial loss in Afghanistan. First of all, Eric Prince knew well that the U.S. Army has failed in Afghanistan.
The mighty U.S. military, the most powerful and expensive military in the history of mankind, gets defeated by largely illiterate goat herders using very simple weapons. AKs, PKs, Dishkas, and homemade explosives. Please, be honest with ourselves. Who can say that our 17 years, trillions of dollars, 2,400 U.S. dead, tens of thousands of wounded, has been a raging success? I would disagree.
Secondly, privatizing the Afghan war by Eric Prince would tremendously reduce the costs.
I've laid out this plan, this alternative, that comes in at less than 8% of what the Pentagon is spending.
Thirdly, the role of Afghanistan mineral deposits in generating revenues and making up for the war expenditure.
Look, I've got a lot of other things. I spend most of my time mining and looking for natural resources in weird places of the world. This would be a passion project. The private sector can do this. The business of America is business. It's not warfare. We've been looking for minerals, and there is an enormous mineral and energy potential in Afghanistan if you could just set security long enough. Okay, so if you have a reliable battalion in the area that can pacify an area, then you can attract the private capital to build.
So Eric Prince's alternative plan for Trump was a meaningful combination of demise and the privatization of the Afghan war.
Now he's president. He's saying, well, they've got like $1 trillion of minerals in Afghanistan. Why don't we at least take it to pay for the war? No, that would be stealing. That would be robbing from them. Trump thinks, well, I don't like the option of leaving anymore. I don't like the option of putting in more troops. Mm-hmm. And he's, in other words, biding his time to introduce the option of, why don't we just give it to my friend Eric Prince, and let him make billions of dollars off of it. That way, the millions he gave us will be repaid by billions from taxpayers.
Mines and Trump were the two keywords that were meaningful in Afghanistan. Wilbur Ross was Trump's Secretary of Commerce. His interview gave a clear picture of Trump's approach toward mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, it hasn't gotten... I mean, the president obviously gave his big speech recently about sending more troops there. You delivered a plan this summer to the president to get the Afghanistan economy back on its feet that relies in part on tapping into the country's estimated $1 trillion in mineral resources, trillion even by Washington standards, right, as you said, a lot of money. The president has said we can use some of those resources to pay, to repay us for what we've spent there. Where does the plan stand, and are we going to be able to benefit from that?
A few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a survey of Afghanistan. It concluded that there was about $1 trillion of natural resources, not counting oil and gas, so copper, lithium, minerals of those sort. That's a big number. And then ultimately getting some big international mining firms to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
But what really goes on in these silent and far-fetched mountains?
We're not a new kid on the block when it comes to Afghanistan. Our first work in Afghanistan started in 1952, and we were there until about 1973. One of the things that we discovered when we started work is that there was a huge amount of mineral data available within the Ministry of Mines and Industries at that time and within the Afghan Geological Survey. This was mostly old Soviet data that went back to... We used the old Soviet data to compile the first assessment of what we call the preliminary assessment of the mineral resources of the country. That was completed in 2010. We were approached by the Department of Defense and said, and they asked us whether or not, or how could they basically increase interest in the development of these mineral resources in these boxes. And we told them, we normally do not go beyond what you see, but if you want to increase the interest, then you need to go into each one of the boxes and develop detailed information and data. We did that. This block map basically includes metallic minerals, industrial minerals, and locations for gemstones or precious stones. So it's a full look at the mineral resource assessment as we look at them in USGS. That confirmed basically that we were right in our assessment because we found what we should have found there.
In the limelight.
After the killing of George Floyd and subsequent mass protests, the USHRN and the ACLU organized an international coalition that urged the HRC to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate systematic racism and police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading UN Report Calls for Reparations for Victims of Systematic Racist Police Violence in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. On June 28, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, released a stunning 23-page report accompanied by a 95-page conference room paper for the UN Human Rights Council, HRC, documenting systematic racism and human rights violations by police forces against Africans and people of African descent throughout the world. The report considered more than 340 interviews and more than 100 submissions from civil society organizations. Bachelet grounded her analysis in the long overdue need to confront the legacies of enslavement, the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans and colonialism, and to seek reparatory justice. She took aim at misconceptions that the abolition of slavery, the end of the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans and colonialism, and subsequent reforms have eliminated the racially discriminatory structures built by those practices and created equal societies. The report finds the dehumanization of people of African descent, a practice rooted in false social constructions of race created to justify enslavement, pervasive racial stereotypes, and widely accepted harmful practices and traditions, has sustained and cultivated a tolerance for racial discrimination, inequality, and violence, which continues to have a disproportionate impact on the enjoyment of their human rights. Systematic racism needs a systematic response, Bachelet wrote. States should adopt a systematic approach to combating racial discrimination through the adoption and monitoring of whole-of-government and whole-of-society responses. They should be designed to dismantle systematic racism. Hailing the report as a victory, the U.S. Human Rights Network, USHRN, issued a statement saying it reflects the efforts of civil society to educate UN officials about human rights violations and the people's solutions, even convening a People's Commission of Inquiry to take on what the UN declined to do last year. After the killing of George Floyd and subsequent mass protests, the USHRN and the ACLU organized an international coalition that urged the HRC to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate systematic racism and police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America. Instead, on June 19, 2020, after intensive lobbying by Trump administration, the HRC adopted Resolution 43-1, directing the High Commissioner to prepare a report on police violence and other human rights violations against Africans and people of African descent around the world, not limited to the United States. Thus, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, National Conference of Black Lawyers, and National Lawyers Guild established their own International Commission Inquiry on systematic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States. The commission issued its report on April 15, 2021. The worldwide mobilization of people calling for racial justice has forced a long-delayed reckoning with racism and shifted debates towards a focus on the systematic nature of racism and the institutions that perpetrate it, Bachelet wrote. Bachelet's report indicts the culture of systematic racism, denial and impunity of law enforcement officials for violating the human rights of people of African descent. She lays blame for the racialization of poverty, a defeat of insufficient, meaningful participation of people of African descent, and decision-making and impediments to their right to vote. Bachelet charges that the dehumanization of people of African descent is rooted in false social constructions of race historically created to justify enslavement, pervasive racial stereotypes, and false narratives that associate people of African descent with criminal activities. Discriminatory identity checks and stops and searches are attributable to racial profiling, according to Bachelet, and she condemns disproportionate stops, arrests, and imprisonment for drug-related offenses. Bachelet's analysis of 190 cases globally, most from the United States, revealed that at least 85% of police-related deaths